Session number 9938, Reel 4.
Mr. Philpott, Reel 4.
Yes, and I was saying the controllers in the control rooms, in the operation rooms, were extremely good, and one of them was Phillips of tobacco fame and so on. And it all seemed to need a great deal of cooperation, tact and vigor in dealing with the RAF and the Navy, which always had to be brought together somehow, and the commanders of the squadrons and the ground crews and so on. They did a wonderful job, I always thought. We 18 group was not distinguished in some respects, for its secrecy. There was we were in existence, for instance, to get at these pocket battleships and anything sizable, the Scharnhorst, the Gneisenau, much in our minds. And there was a plan, Fuller it was called, out to intercept the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, the battle cruisers, either, as is generally known, either in southwest of Britain or up in the north where we were, and up by Iceland and so on. And this is an elaborate plan that was all worked out, called Plan Fuller. And believe it or not, when I was at Northcote's Aerodrome in April 1941, going back a wee bit, and there wasn't much doing, and I went to the operations room just to read up the latest information and so on, somebody tossed me Plan Fuller and said, "You might like to look at this." I was merely a flying officer and no particular power except to drive an aeroplane. And I studied this. My eyes stood right out. This is a detailed plan of what, of how the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau would have to be intercepted by air, ourselves, Bristol Beauforts, and every other air squadron you could think of, suitable bombers and so on, and the British Navy. When they came out of Brest, where they were cowering and where they formed this enormous danger to our food convoys upon which we lived. And I read that, and I never said anything about it to anybody. And much later, in Stalaglöf 3, much later, I heard a pilot or two also being captured. In early 1942, mentioned Plan Fuller by name. And I said, "My God, that's top security, you know." And people shut up about it, but we certainly weren't very good. I don't say 18 group were totally careless or anything, but certainly on Plan Fuller, I bet the enemy had some idea of it. And of course, later in 1942, after I was shot down, Scharnhorst and Gneisenau came bouncing out of Brest and headed right through the British, the channel here, our channel, and got away into Germany without being sunk, which is, of course, a parliamentary inquiry, I think. I remember telling you when we first conversed that my last flight was on the 11th of December, 1941, and that was referred to, the crash at the end of that off Norway, was referred to in my book, Stolen Journey, which is a complimentary book to Eric Williams' Wooden Horse. And it didn't, Stolen Journey did not describe why I was busy landing in the North Sea. And the fact was, on that last flight of mine, that last operational flight of mine in 42 Squadron, I set out full of great optimism on the 11th December, in spite of the fact that news had just come through that the Japanese were in the war and the US was making gestures to come in too, and we'd lost the Prince of Wales and the Repulse in off Singapore, or not all that distant, in off Malaysia, and everything is pretty gloomy. Nevertheless, I was all set for a rover patrol with bombs to attack shipping. And I went out on this. This is one of the Spanish Armada controls, and I headed down towards the southwest Norway. And there was a good deal of cloud. This is daytime, which is pleasing because it was cloud cover and you felt not quite so endangered. And I didn't see any ships, but I remember whizzing past a lighthouse, which we photographed with our camera. And as I did so, working down the Norwegian coast, I saw over to my right the tailplane of a Junkers 88, a German bomber, not unlike our Bristol Beaufort, going out off in our direction, presumably to attack British convoys going down the East British coast, and they flashed away. And then I flew over an aerodrome there, and the air gunner said he peppered some gun posts and so on, which did not fire at us. They probably thought we were Germans in the comparative fog or misty conditions anyway. And then I was just wondering whether we were going to see a ship. I wanted one ship, maybe. And suddenly we came out, and there was an entire convoy of about 20 ships coming up in a northerly direction, in southwest Norway there. And I immediately hollered out, "Attack, attack," and we went in with our bombs. I was fortunate in a way in that I was coming from the Norwegian side, and they probably thought I was a German aircraft to start with, and I attacked the first ship I could see that I came across, and this convoy coming up at masthead, again managing to avoid the mast. I never really discovered whether I hit anything or not, because the story was slightly confused, but the air gunner later said he saw some signs of a hit with bombs, but certainly we didn't hang about and see whether the ship sank or anything like that. The great thing is, once you drop your bombs, they get out and get home. And I shot off in a homeward direction, avoiding the other masts of this convoy. It's a big convoy. And thinking, well, whatever happens, we can get out across the North Sea and home. And I suddenly looked, and I looked automatically, really, at my petrol gauges and my instruments showing the performance of the starboard engine, which is nil. It is, and the air gunner helpfully said, the wireless operator who was peering out of the hatch on that side, he said helpfully, "Yes, there's a stream of oil coming from your right engine." And so I'd lost the right engine, and there's no particular future in that. And so I got clear of the convoy, staggered on, and the engine was passing out, and I landed it in the sea, because I couldn't do anything else, because they're no good in one engine. And I remember there was such a wind blowing that December, such a wind that we had 11 degrees of drift. In other words, the aircraft anyway went 11 degrees sideways, and the waves were quite tremendous. Well, in a situation like that, if you're going to land, in the sea, you've got to keep the nose up, not ram it into the waves. And so I kept the nose up and just waited for it, sagging down as I throttled back the other engine and waited for it. Fortunately, we did not go nose into one of these immense waves, and I think we probably bridged two waves, the nose on one wave and the tail on the other, because it broke in half, just the tail end of the rear gunners, and sank, as far as I can make out, in 45 seconds. And the rest of this was the introduction to Stolen Journey, where I suddenly found the water up to my neck, and navigator and I came up like corks coming out of a bottle, coming up out of the hatch above the cockpit, which we'd opened. And the great thing was not to be trapped inside, which we weren't. And then we went swimming down and looked anxiously towards the port wing, where providentially Flight Sergeant Hester, who was the air gunner, was holding the dinghy according to our drill. And with one hand on what remained of the aircraft, it was sinking fast, and holding the dinghy, which providentially was inflated. And we splashed our way towards this, and Rakow, the navigator, said, "After you." And I said, classic and pretty stupid remark, I'm captain of this aircraft, you get on, you get up in the dinghy first, go on, which was held against me for some time. Classic and stupid remark. And we all piled into the dinghy.
As you say, I think we're now on to the story of Stolen Journey.
Yes, that's
so
right.
If we can jump ahead to Stalaglove 3 and
right.
The wooden horse escape now.
Yes, fine.
Could you tell me about the story of the wooden horse?
Yes, you're not on here. Well, from the dinghy, we were, after 45 hours, picked up, as I recount in Stolen Journey. We had, first of all, drifted out that December day from the Norwegian coast, which got smaller and smaller, and the four of us are sitting in this thing, carefully one opposite to the other to balance it, and we went shooting up one wave and slithering down another, occasional splashes of water coming into the dinghy. And there was a patrolling German aircraft which came over us, and we tried to operate one of our flares there in rather half-hearted direction, because we didn't really know whether the German aircraft would shoot us up or send out some people to rescue us, because we could do some rescuing, even if it was by the enemy. And we're a bit half-hearted about this anyway, and we couldn't operate the flare with our hands, which got a bit cold. And the aircraft went by. Then we spent the night in the dinghy. There was nothing else to do. I remember it went, became quite a clear night, and I watched the dipper, as I call it, pirouette around in the heavens there, and stared at it, and none of us said very much. We felt a little bit lonely and distinctly cold. And in the dawn, we waited till we were up on top of one of these large waves, and looked all round, and we couldn't see the coast at all, or sign of anything. And another aircraft came round, but again it didn't see us. And we slept the second night there, We slept in an endless chain with our hands in the crutch of the chap ahead of us in a circle around the dinghy, keep our hands warm. And the second morning, we found we drifted in to Norway, presumably somewhere, I think, by Egersund, but I'm never quite certain. And we could see no chance, even if we could get near the cliffs, with the size of these cliffs, we could see no chance of scrambling ashore and scrambling up a cliff, and you couldn't see any beaches or anything. And we were drifting towards them, and then suddenly we saw a convoy, a German convoy, going in the opposite direction from the original one, going south, around what's called the Nes, the southwestern tip of Norway. And we debated whether to let off a flare or not, and decided we weren't much good for anything by that time. In any case, and we decided to let off a flare, and this time the flare worked, and a flak ship came along to us, alongside us, a little thing like a tugboat, really, in size, bearing anti-aircraft weapons, and came shooting alongside, and we went right up near its deck, and then right down again till we could practically see the keel, as it were, and then right up again. But the German Navy were very good and leant over the side and snatched at us one after another and dragged us on board. And they took us downstairs, down below decks, and immediately gave us some hot soup, which is very good. And we listened to the German radio saying how wonderful it was the Japanese had come into the war and that Singapore was about to fall and all the news, which is totally adverse. They brought along a bucket of hot water because my feet were giving trouble. I'd stupidly flown in ordinary shoes, which is my fault, and stupid. And my feet had blown up with the cold, and ridiculously put them into this hot water, which of course made frostbite even worse. And Freddy, the wireless operator, had got something wrong with his hand and so on. He was a bit shocked anyway, because he'd only done two operational flights in Beauforts, and one had been somewhere in the south of England, which had landed him in the mud, because they'd done a forced landing in the mud, and I'd landed him in the sea off Norway. So he took rather a jaundiced view of it all. And we were just taken around Norway, around the Nes, and up towards Kristiansand. And then the Luftwaffe came and took charge of us. They were very polite, and asked us a few questions, and we shook our heads. We couldn't answer any questions. I knew some German as a result of being there, but my German is never very good. But I could often understand what they were saying, and I didn't let on. And they put us in a hospital in Kristiansand and bound up my feet, which was helpful. And later, we went to the to the Aker Sykehus, sick house really, a hospital in Oslo, which is a famous one, I think, were put up there. We went to an excellent ward to start with, which had all the works. It must have been a very, very swank bit of the hospital. And the Luftwaffe came in and said, "Well, for you the war is ended." That's what they always say. Everybody's captured. For you, the war is ended now. Let us see, what were you doing in your aircraft? What sort of aircraft was it? And were you carrying bombs? And did you attack a ship? And so on and so forth. And what are you doing here? And it is all over now. You can talk. Well, we could give name, rank, and number, and then shut up. So we announced this name, rank, and number. That's all we can give you. And so in a very short time, we were dumped in a sort of poor part of the hospital. No, that's perfectly efficient. And the glorious lemonade and so on we were given and so on was taken away. And we were given rather ordinary rations, which is nothing to grumble about. And over the days that followed, they kept looking at my feet and shaking their head. We had in the ward a chap called Archer, who'd been an air gunner, who'd come up Oslo Fjord in a Hamden with bombs and they had been shot down. And he'd lost a foot. And they used to come in and look at his foot, sort of fierce-looking surgeon. And then he'd come and look at my foot. And the orderly would say later, well, my feet really, Vielleicht ja, vielleicht nein. I said, you know, are these going to be chopped off or what? Perhaps so, perhaps not. Anyway, I had the luck of the devil and the feet recovered. And I could hear through, we could hear through the walls of this hospital room in the Akasikihus. We could hear moaning and groaning from chaps who'd really got frostbite, who were Germans who'd been dragged back from the Russian front. And they'd had a bit of the winter out there, and a lot of them were in a really bad way. We heard them groaning away there, just through the partition. Then we were taken down after a number of weeks. It is announced that we're going to a prison camp and going to leave this Norwegian hospital. And we're taken down through Oslo Fjord, which is all frozen. And they put us in the nose of the ship up by the anchor. And we could hear the ice of Oslo Fjord being broken by the bows of the ship as it crashed its way down towards Aalborg in North Denmark. And there we got a train right down through Denmark and to Hamburg. And ironically enough, I went to the same hotel in Hamburg which I'd been to some time before. As a trainee examining the margarine for Kaufsunion and free at the time. And here I was plonked in the hall with a couple of soldiers keeping a close eye on me. From there, went down in a train through Hanover. We were looking round all the time for the bombing because BBC and so on had told us that heavy bombing raids on Germany, and we hoped Germany is showing some signs that they're losing the war or something. And actually, everything looked absolutely perfect. There was some damage, obviously, I'm sure, but it wasn't very obvious. And then we got right down to Frankfurt, the Western Frankfurt, and at a station there, I remember, we were led in at night to a buffet there where the chap produced some sandwiches and so on, some cafe, which is useful. And then we were actually dog-tired by this time, absolutely worn out by all this wandering about under guard and ships and airplanes, ships and trains and things. And he leant across on his elbows and he said, Singapore, you will lose it, you will lose it. And so he hotly answered, say, nine, nine, we won't, but secretly we know blinking where we would. And then in the early morning, we were marched through Frankfurt, and approached, in the end, some way, Duleg Luft, which is the interrogation camp of for the RAF, or the Luftwaffe, to interrogate their prisoners. This wasn't at all a terrible thing, as it might sound. And Mr. Bauer looked in, a Luftwaffe officer, and he said, "How are you? How are you? I have ordered some more coffee for you." And he said, "Thanks very much. Thanks very much. Now then, the war is now over. You start in the old game again. And what were you flying? What were you doing?" And so on and so forth. And we said, no, we can't answer these things. Name, rank, and number. And he said, this is Schade. This is a bad thing. And he said, "All you have to do is to sign a Red Cross form." And so we peered at the Red Cross form. And of course, it asked for elementary details, but one's family and one thing and another, where you, your age and so on. And then it said type of aircraft flown, number of squadron, and the whole lot on a Red Cross form. So handed it back to Mr. Bayer, said, "No, you can't sign anything like this." And he huffed and puffed and went away. And another man came in, a Luftwaffe man, who said, "You will soon be in a prison camp." We said, "Well, it's high time. I think we're hanging about curious places, so on. We'd like to see some of our friends." And he said, yes, he said, they are there. We have Bada and so on. We have this man and that man, and we have Tuck and so on." And I said, yes, just a fluke, really, but they certainly gave you a bit of a time before you got them, didn't they? And he didn't like that much. And he was really there to test our morale. He was the man gauging morale. He said, "Well, you have lost this war. It is quite clear. You must admit that as a man of the world." I said, "Admit no such thing." And so he went away in a bit of a huff. And then we're let loose in Duleg Luft. And it was a hutted camp. And we said, "How do we get out of this? What happens?" And they told us there's just been an attempted escape. And a tunnel has been dug. And they waved to a snow-covered bit of the enclosure of inside the wire in Duleg Luft, and various people got out, including Johnny Dodge, who is a cousin of Churchill's, who for some obscure reason, he's a major, was mixed up with the RAF, and the RAF loved him dearly and didn't grumble. Wouldn't have made any difference if we did. And we said, "Well, what are the features of this?" And they described the tunnel and so on. But the message had come back. Johnny had a huge, great shoulders. And Johnny's stuck. The message came back. How he unstuck himself. And they all streaked out and made off. But they didn't get much of an advance without the enemy seeing them. And in the morning, there were apparently 10 Green Line-type coaches, we'd call them Green Line coaches, that sort of size, with all sorts of people, Home Guard people, the German equivalent, I think, streaming out of these and going off in various trails looking for the chaps who come out of the tunnel. And of course,